Hej kära lyssnare, älskar du Checkpoint?
Men det är klart de gör.
Mm-hmm. Då kan du stötta oss via Acasts nya supporterfunktion.
Och här kommer du själv välja vilket belopp du vill stötta med. Och framförallt, ingen bindningstid.
Klicka på länken i poddbeskrivningen och hjälp oss hålla podden i liv.
January 2010, an earthquake destroys Haiti.
Yes.
And I get my break. The UN was like, hey, we need somebody who could be a spokesperson for us in English, French, and Haitian Creole.
Oh.
And I'm like, what? All these years, nobody cared that I spoke Haitian Creole until today.
Yeah.
And I took the opportunity and I got on a, quit my job at a tech firm. And a week later, was on a plane to Haiti.
Välkomna till Checkpoint, ett safe space i poddformat där vi pratar om allt ifrån politik, populärkultur, karriär, kreativitet, you name it. Men kruxet är att det är ur ett svart perspektiv.
Där våra obekväma samtal blir väldigt bekväma utifrån våra härliga röster.
Verkligen.
Oftast med tunga gäster som droppar sanningar. Men vi finns alltid här. Your girl Anbara.
Med mig Brandon.
Och med mig Nicole.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. And you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to a special episode of Checkpoint, and as you can tell, this week's episode will be in English. We are joined by a special guest who has worked as a communications advisor at the United Nations around the world, specializing in diversity and inclusion. He is a humanitarian, a journalist, an acclaimed novelist, where his book God Loves Haiti was praised by the New York Times. This Harvard alum has globetrotted his way around the world, and the stars have aligned as he now resides in Stockholm, working as a senior advisor at the sustainability consultancy Ethos, which is a stone's throw from where we are meeting at Acos today here in central Stockholm. We are so honored to have you here with us today. So a big welcome to Checkpoint, Dimitri Léger.
Yay!
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I think we are kind of starstruck to have you here, to be honest.
Yes, after reading your amazing resume.
Thanks. I love the podcast. Without understanding much of it, I still enjoy hearing you guys debate. I could feel the anger, the humor, and the intellectual searching, and I really appreciate it. So it's an honor to be here.
I'm glad. We are here in the studio today, myself and Anbara, with you. Brandon, unfortunately, is home with a sick child, but he sends his regards. And this is exciting. We've had requests, obviously, to do the podcast in English, but we just hadn't gotten there yet until we bumped into you here at Acast. And it was like, it's the classic, you know, there's not that many black people around. And when you see them, you're like, hey! Literally, you like came over and gave me a hug.
For sure.
And we're like, couldn't we like have a drink?
Yes. Yes.
And you just happen to be the most fascinating, role model. I mean, I am literally starstruck. I mean, you are such a nice person just meeting you. But then, like Amber, I said, when we started Googling you, we're like, holy shit, okay. Yeah. This is huge.
I really appreciate it. And it's good that the research was helpful. And you haven't read the book, so that's good too, because that might color how you feel about me. So this is good.
I doubt. But that will be something that we do.
Yes.
But we normally always ask
our guests. Yeah, Brandon always asks our guests, who are you? So let me pretend to be Brandon today. So who are you?
I'm a writer. I'm a sustainability and human rights advocate. I'm Haitian. I'm a Brooklynite. I moved to Brooklyn when I was 2 years old. Born in Haiti, moved to Brooklyn when I was 2 years old, and grew up in New York all the way through high school in Brooklyn, university for my first degree in Queens, and loved journalism, loved to read. I loved to read so much that eventually I had to write because I felt like I had to almost give back to the writers who gave me so much pleasure.
Mm. Oh, interesting.
I had to enter the conversation, enter the community of writers.
Mm.
So it was a debate between English major and becoming a teacher. Or make money immediately, which was journalism. And this is the 90s when there were actually very good jobs in journalism.
Yeah.
There were amazing magazines.
Yeah.
There were always good newspapers, but there were amazing magazines at the time. And I wanted to enter that world because I love reading them. And I became a journalist in the 90s and in my 20s and wrote about hip hop for a long time. Interviewed all my favorite rappers.
Who did you?
Yeah, that's what I want to know. Who did you interview?
But people who are still around, like, you know, Snoop Dogg, Diddy, Nas.
Snoop Double O.
Yep, Double OG.
Double OG.
And he nicknamed me Narc.
Narc? Why? Did he think that your aura was like a bit narc?
I love that. That's hilarious.
I was interviewing him in Miami during Super Bowl festivities, and it was a basketball game. And after the game, all the players were in the locker room. I wasn't a player, of course, but I was in the locker room hanging out. And of course, somebody broke out a joint. And I mean, this is a hip hop basketball game, of course. So at halftime, you smoke a joint. And as it made the rounds, I had to skip me. I don't smoke.
Yeah.
And
you didn't puff.
Nope. No, I didn't do it to impress the gang. And it came back around. And I still passed. And then he was like, wait a minute. How do you work for the biggest hip hop magazine in the country and been covering hip hop for so many years and be, you know, 22 or 23 and have dreadlocks and don't smoke weed? And I'm like, well, because, you know, somebody has to be different.
Yeah, true.
You could like Bob Marley and not smoke weed.
Yeah, true.
You could look like Bob Marley and not smoke weed.
True.
And it's like, admit it, you're a narc. Admit it, you're a narc. You're an undercover cop. I'm like, no, I'm not undercover cop. I'm like, you sure? And then they kept on smoking. 2 hours later, at this point, I'm on clouds. I never heard of before. And then and somebody was new to the circle and they were circling around, and then that person tried to give it to me, and Snoop was like, no, he doesn't smoke, he's the narc, skip him. and from then on, it's like 5 years later, hey, narc, what up?
So it stuck. Yeah,
it stuck. But I covered hip hop and it was great. One of the highlights was De La Soul. I spent a week in the studio with them for the Face magazine, the UK magazine.
Yeah.
And that was great. They were recording the album called Stakes Is High. And at one point they were doing a song where there's a group chorus.
Yeah.
And they asked me to join.
No.
Yes. How are you hiding all of this? Absolutely brilliant information. I can't even.
That was a highlight.
Making the news.
After about 5 years or 8 years of doing that, my opportunity came to become a business journalist. And I was like, why not? A new challenge. Interviewing tech and startup leaders.
Mm.
Back then, Silicon Valley was just starting up. It was just booming with the internet companies. And one of my first assignments was to go interview the Google guys. when there were just 15 employees.
Oh, so they were really small back then.
Yeah, 15 employees had basically just started the thing, but it was blowing up. We didn't smoke weed. different scene, but we skateboarded.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Yeah. Pool, you know, and that was more dangerous than smoking weed on the skateboard because I was not that good. But we skateboarded and hung out for a few days in Silicon Valley. And that led to wanting to be curious about working for companies inside and seeing how you could help companies tell their stories better.
Yes, true.
And also along the way, I married a Swede. And I thought, eventually, we won't move to Sweden, but we might want to move to Europe.
And
I needed a career that was more mobile than journalism. And so then I went in grad school and did international development. And as fate would have it, lucked into a job in Geneva. Moved to Geneva and basically lived there up until 3 months ago. And moving here, moving to Stockholm. But yeah, I got into advocacy, championing sustainable development, economic collaboration, and got to live out another dream, which was humanitarianism. Mm.
Yes.
And actually, when I applied to grad school in 2001, the first sentence was, I need this degree to get a job at the UN.
Yes.
In Haiti. Mm. And I wrote that letter in 2001, the application essay. I started applying for jobs in the UN when I got to grad school in 2004. Mm. Never got even an interview. And then January 2010, an earthquake destroys Haiti.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I get my break. The UN was like, hey, we need somebody who could be a spokesperson for us in English, French, and Haitian Creole.
Oh.
And I'm like, what? All these years, nobody cared that I spoke Haitian Creole until today.
Yeah.
And I took the opportunity and I got on quit my job at a tech firm. And a week later, I was on a plane to Haiti.
And how did it feel like going back to your motherland, but in a crisis?
You know, there's no place like home.
Yeah.
Like the cliche goes. I knew I was flying into a complete mess. I mean, I'd seen the images on CNN.
Yes.
And that freaked everyone out. And I was not insensitive to that. But I have family there.
Mm.
And we were lucky enough that nobody got hurt.
Mm.
And it's about like 16 people, like cousins and their spouses and their two kids. We all had the same life, spouse and two kids. But they were there and no one got hurt. It took 2 days of worrying, and then I got the news that no one got hurt.
Mm.
Then I'm like, once again, we got blessed.
Yeah.
Because we've always been kind of lucky on the island.
Mm.
And 300,000 people died, and not one hair got touched in my family. So with that in mind, going in was like, okay, I got to give back.
Yeah.
It's the least I could do.
Yeah.
And I had my trepidations, but once you got to the airplane, and they opened the door, and you felt the heat.
Yeah.
And the heat in Haiti is equatorial heat. It's like fire.
Yeah.
But once I felt it for the first time in a few years, it was like, I'm home.
I'm home.
And it was nice to be useful.
Yeah.
It was more rewarding than anything I did before that, and more rewarding than anything I did after that, to be honest. It was 8 months. I lived in a tent. We organized food drops, water drops, medicine drops. I took celebrities around and journalists around to check out the disaster zone. And you had the 3 press conferences a week, and you're trying to convey a sense of hope and convey a sense of urgency.
Yes.
So you want the international community to be helpful.
Yeah.
And you need a sense that if you do help the country, you will be doing good and there will be progress made.
Yes.
But at the same time, shit was real.
Yeah.
We had to figure out how to bury 300,000 people.
Oh, my God.
And there are 300,000 corpses littered around. And it's like, okay, how do you bury them?
Mm. Yeah, because they can't stay out in the heat.
Exactly. Exactly. And they can't be identified. Families can come and identify. Yeah. I mean, you can't do anything like that. Some of the scarier things were like, well, a water drop. You know, just, you know, 3 million refugees. So you're dropping, you're organizing a water drop. Say, hey, everybody come at 11 o'clock at this corner. We'll have a truck and we'll give them bottles of water.
It's going to be chaos.
Yes.
Absolute chaos.
Yes, because you won't have enough water.
Yeah, and people will know that.
People will know that.
Why stand in line?
Yeah.
So people will stand in line from 6 a.m.
Yeah.
In hopes that they're at the front of the line. And then you have to control for the fact that you could help the people. I mean, we had like 50,000 bottles once, and that's 50,000 people. That means it's probably going to be another 50,000 people in the back of the line who won't get it.
Yeah.
And we're going to be upset.
Yeah.
She had to control for that. Eventually, we had to learn, we had to control for the fact that people who did get food or water on the way home, they could get robbed. So you had to control for that. So there's a lot of learning by doing.
Yeah.
But it was definitely more useful than anything I was doing in Geneva.
Yeah.
Anything I did since, because it was like, well, better to have organized a water drop and give somebody a bottle of water who's super thirsty after losing their home and their neighbors and half their family. It was really rewarding work.
I can feel that.
By
the way you're talking and obviously helping out your people and your country is very inspiring.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, just getting it, because I think most of us remember when this happened.
Yeah.
Either you were maybe a kid or you definitely remember it. And it's just, it's rewarding and touching to hear the other side of the story. And also the complexity of, like you're describing, that you still have to package the crisis and we work with advertising.
Still
have to package and sell that this is a crisis where people should give money to. Like it's crazy
baffling.
Having to do that. It really baffles me that's of course that's what you have to do. And at the same time trying to, you know, make the logistics and the practicalities of burying and helping people. This is all still real. Like you're saying, it must have felt so, it's like you're in two different, in parallel universes where it's, on the one hand, it's important to package it to get the donations.
Yeah, marketing communications is important.
Yeah.
But sometimes it seems really absurd.
Yeah.
If we look at some of the biggest crises that's happened, whilst following it on the news and you see like, oh, this celebrity has come. And you can see like all the work it takes just to lead this celebrity.
Yes, I've organized those.
But it's taking away so much resources.
Yeah.
I always wonder, like, why do these celebrities say okay to that? Or why do they feel, because I understand that they shed light, but they can also do it by maybe lending their social medias to people on the ground instead of them going down there, because the logistics is ridiculous.
It is. But on a marketing standpoint, you just can't beat it.
Yeah.
I had to organize a lot of photo ops with, you know, celebrities and orphans. I did it because I subsequently worked all over Africa, and they draw a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Unless Angelina Jolie comes to town, people don't know that country exists and don't want to know that country exists.
Yeah.
Angelina Jolie's presence makes a huge difference.
She was just in Ukraine, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and before that she was in Yemen.
Yep.
Yeah.
And she's done Sudan, she's done Somalia. I mean, because also this is not just
but her,
publicity.
I feel a huge sincerity in her work. I feel like everything she does, also like the amount of money she gives to charity and being like an ambassador, I feel like she's doing it in a sincere way. But then there's other celebrities that are only doing it for like a photo op.
I know.
To show like, yeah, look at me, I'm doing something good.
Look, but everyone can't be Sean Penn. And Sean Penn is brilliant.
He does the work.
He was in Haiti, and he does the work. We opened a women's clinic together.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Like
oh my God, so you're like friends with Sean Penn.
I don't know if we're friends. But one time I came to the office, and I got a call from the Secretary General's office, the head of the UN, saying, you need to call. And I called, and it's like, yeah, Sean Penn is looking for you. And it's like, oh, okay. Call him now. So he called the head of the UN looking for me, and I call him up, and he's like, dude, come over. I go see him, and he wants to open a women's clinic. He was managing a refugee camp of 50,000 people.
Oh, my God.
A whole golf course. 50,000 people. It's like a village. It's like a town.
That's
and,
a lot.
And we were helping him. Like, with refugee camps, there's a lot of things you have to do. Like, I was with the UNFPA, the agency that represents women. Mm-hmm. So, women and girls. So, we want to... There's ways you have to set up a refugee camp to make sure women and girls are safe.
Yes.
And we were working with him on that. And then he heard, okay, I'm the guy who gets things done. And he had the idea, well, his celebrity girlfriend at the moment gave him the idea that there should be a women's health clinic on the refugee camp. Mm. Refugee camp can't just have one hospital. It has to have also a hospital for women and girls.
100%.
Just for them.
Mm. Yes.
And it took a few weeks and we got all the, we did have a hygiene kit.
Yeah.
These kits that have everything women and girls need. Mm. And then we built a clinic with like wood and we just did it. And then we set up this big photo op with the Secretary General flew in from New York with Sean Penn, symbolically giving a hygiene kit to a little Haitian girl. And then the world press was there and that generated aid. It generated aid. The thing about celebrities, good and bad, their presence unlocks pocketbooks.
I understand, but some...
There's a lot of taxpayer money that pays for aid.
Yeah.
And the taxpayers, when they're told to do it by Kim Kardashian, they're more persuaded than by me or by an orphan.
Hej, det här är Alice Bakunke och du lyssnar till min favoritpodd Checkpoint. Om du vill få fler perspektiv på livet, om du vill skratta, kanske gråta lite, skakas om, provoceras, fnula fram någonting härligt utifrån andras tankar. Lyssna på Checkpoint.
Unlocking capital is not easy. And for as long as anyone can remember, at least 500 years now, I mean, all the capital, most of the capital in the world is concentrated in a handful of countries.
Yeah, true.
When they are generous, like the UN budget is still a fraction of the average arms deal budget for the Security Council countries.
Yes.
The five countries that run the UN sell the most arms, and they also, you know, decide who does where peacemakers go. They still fund all humanitarian activities. And so you're sitting there sometimes in a war zone, you're like, ah, today was a good day. I wasn't killed by a landmine.
Yeah.
Created by my employer.
Yes.
Because my employer it's not necessarily the UN, it's really, you know, Congress and French Parliament and the British Parliament.
Oh, I've never thought of it in that perspective. Really interesting.
I've started to because I do have both family and family friends where some of the men are in the UN troops in various different countries in different times. My cousin is actually off as we speak. So I have thought about it a lot because I'm like, why are there UN troops? Then I know from what I understand is obviously their job is to kind of, you know, help kids get to school safely and like all these things. But it's still, exactly, it's still...
But we've known
the army.
I understand that we have UN soldiers in various countries for peacekeeping. But we've also gotten reports from a lot of African countries saying that UN soldiers, mainly from France,
there was this big
have
report.
Been using kids.
That was horrible.
So at the same time, they're not really doing what they're supposed to. So
soldiers, having done enough war zones now that, you know, soldiers are still people. And peacekeepers are still people. Overwhelmingly, they do the right thing. But there will be bad apples.
Yeah.
But for the most part, particularly with peacekeepers, because it's more dangerous than representing the army of your country. The army of your country in these situations would protect you better than the peacekeeping operation. So you volunteer to be a peacekeeper. It's a detour from your military career.
Okay.
But it puts yourself in more danger. Because it's literally peacekeeping as opposed to war making.
Yeah.
It's a defensive position at all times.
So not engaging in combat.
Yes.
At all times.
No. You're not policing. You're just secure. You're just providing security. For example, in Mali, where I worked a lot, you're just basically protecting the capital. From the, because they lost the north. Malian government lost the north.
Yeah.
So you're just protecting the capital and the south. And when possible, in the north, you police a little bit so that humanitarians can deliver aid.
All right.
You're providing cover for me and my colleagues to come in and deliver water, medicine, and food. But you're just protecting us. Convoy, armored car, armed protection.
That's it.
But meanwhile, the French army is sitting down the street with like No, they're ready. They have snipers. They have everything.
Ready for combat.
Ready for combat. Armies are ready for combat. Peacekeepers create peace.
Okay.
And what they do is create a space for humanitarians to operate.
All right. Got it.
So it's a passive position.
Mm. Wow. There's so many.
No, but like.
So many more questions.
After being like traveling to Kenya a lot with my family, UN has been like, hopefully, like one of them. Yeah, I would really like to work there in the future. Mm-hmm. But in order to really make good changes in the continent, in yes. Africa. Mm. My question to you is then, what I've seen after going to like Kenya and seeing like United Nations people working there or different organizations, most people on the ground are white.
Yep. The typical, the difficult office situation was just like my office situation here. It was just about like being in Stockholm. It's almost 80% of all management jobs in the UN are held by people with Northern European passports.
That's so crazy.
And not European passports, Northern European passports. So basically,
Northern European passports.
Basically, Scandinavians, the Brits, the Dutch, and the French. And the Belgians and the Germans.
Okay. Within those 80%, what would you estimate the numbers to be in terms of diversity?
They're 99% white. I mean, and occasionally you'd have me. With my American passport in it. There's not that many Americans working at the UN in the senior levels because the American government does not insist on that. Mm-hmm. The Americans donate the most money to the UN. Yeah. But most Americans who want to do foreign services, who want to deliver aid, go work for the U.S. aid agency.
Yes.
USAID.
Yes.
And the USAID funds everything anyway. So it's like, wait, do you want to work for the UN who has to beg USAID for money, or do you want to work for USAID who gives the money?
Mm. Yes, I've seen them do a lot
they do
right
amazing
now
work
in Africa.
And they fund everything. Mm. So most Americans go there. I happen to get caught up in the UN because I live in Geneva.
Yeah.
And I specifically wanted to be a humanitarian.
Yeah. Mm.
But turns out, yes, Northern Europeans run the organization.
That's so crazy.
Because for every dollar they give, they insist on jobs. So a dollar Sweden gives, Norway gives. Germany gives. The Brits run all the communications operations everywhere. And the French run everything administratively.
Mm.
That's why the UN has two languages, official languages, English and French. Mm. And most people are French. Most of the places run in French. Wow. So you have to be very fluent in French to operate there.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We can talk about this for hours and hours, but we do only have limited time. But I it was interesting the parallel that you made, that working in the UN, which I think for many is a dream. I know, just like you said, Ambara, it's always been a dream of yours.
Yes.
I've had the same dream, you know, that was kind of the goal. That's the epitome of, you know, not just success, but also making a difference, because many of us do want to change the world. I know I do. But it was just interesting having that parallel, knowing that it was a really, really big dream of yours and you're saying it was still some of the best work and the best experience you've ever had. And yet being there, you're still not able to, you know, do that and being fully yourself and having the parallel into, yeah, it was all of these fantastic things, but it was still exactly the same. Or what it's like working in Sweden, as in being the only black person or one of few.
Yes. It's interesting because the black middle class, black people who are qualified enough to do these kind of works and doing this kind of work on a senior level, is bigger in the U.S. than it is in Europe.
Yeah.
Because the U.S. has created all these policies, because it's all about policy making. And since the 60s, the U.S. has these policies. So universities set up, you know, 5% of their spots in every university is reserved for people of African descent.
Yeah.
5%. The population is 12%. So it's not really proportionate.
Yeah.
But that 5% leads to 5% of the law schools, of the medical schools, of the engineering schools, of the journalism schools, the international, the economic schools. So that creates this huge brain power, this huge talent pool, and has created tremendous wealth. Yeah. You know, Black Americans are probably the wealthiest group of Black people on the planet because their per capita income is insane compared to elsewhere. So there's the talent pool factor. And then when it comes to doing humanitarian work and it comes to doing sustainability work, it's still seen as is virtuous and not lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
So at my firm here in Stockholm, at Ethos, you know, recruiting is a challenge because when recruiting people who want to do sustainability, they tend to be in their 20s and idealistic and come from families that can afford you to take this detour,
sure,
as opposed to going to PwC, BlackRock, Goldman, or one of the massive car companies or energy companies to do the same thing. It's really hard. It's not as lucrative as doing it in-house and at a firm. So I remember when I was talking to the role, for me, it was like, okay, well, this is what we do in the UN. We advocate for these stuff, but this stuff, we invented all these terms.
Yeah.
You know, all this climate action and human rights and gender equality, the sustainable development goals. We invented those things 20 years ago. And I never thought anyone was listening as a spokesperson. But turns out there was a firm here in Stockholm that's been doing this for 15 years.
Yeah.
Struggling to get you Swedish companies to care about the environment, to care about diversity, to care about their human rights footprint, all across their stakeholder chain, their supply chain. They've been doing this for 15 years. Now it's trendy, now it's hot, but it's still a challenge to get a hot young lawyer to come through and do human rights advocacy, due diligence, because we do due diligence. We go to the deep in the minefields, deep in the cornfields to see whether the people you're employing to make your clothes or to farm are being paid a fair wage and not being abused. Companies hire us and send us out there to do these things.
Yes.
A law firm that hires you to do this would pay you a lot more than we could.
Mm.
So there's a challenge of getting people over the age of 35, for example. Super hard.
Yeah.
Because it's more lucrative for those people to be in-house at a big firm, not caring about the environment. And that goes across the line. It goes the same way in this kind of consulting in the private sector and also within the UN. It's competitive talent pool.
Hmm.
It's hard to make the case for the average Black person, for the talented, actually, Black person to leave lucrative opportunities in Stockholm, in Copenhagen, and to go down to Africa for less to pay and more danger. It's a hard sell.
It's a really hard sell. But if we look at what's happening right now in a lot of parts of Africa and in the Middle East, so there's a huge torka.
Drought,
yes. This drought is really getting worse. Like the crisis is added with the food crisis, mainly because of the lack of grain that used to come from parts of
Ukraine. Mm-hmm.
Leading to that a lot of people are basically starving.
Yes. And it's going to get a lot worse.
Mm.
The economy is quite globalized, so it's kind of hard. Everybody's kind of interdependent.
Yeah.
One role we can play as people with dual background, is that convincing the NATO countries to share their wealth in a fair way with the developing countries. Basically, if people as talented as you guys and your friends were working for the Swedish aid agency, then you could bridge the gap between their feel and understanding of the challenge being faced by Kenya, for example.
Mm.
As you could help play both sides and help them channel the aid right.
Yes.
Like, for example, the problem is going to be really bad. The energy prices and wheat and all those things are going to be really, it's going to be bad here.
Yeah.
It's going to be extra awful in Africa. So we got to make sure there's money in the budget that's generated, that's channeled towards the various developing countries, the least developing countries that need this.
Yeah.
And the case can be made, better made in-house at CEDA. I think it's it could be better made. It can be well made by everybody, but it could be better made by people like us.
Yes.
People like you.
I think that we're going to see, or we are seeing this change where, because it's not just, you know, first generation immigrant or whatever, or second generation, whatever they want to call people and us. It is, like you're saying, I mean, so many people that have lived for generations or, you know, I was born and raised here, but there's kind of a, maybe there's a mole situation where, you know, we've kind of, we've grown up and we've lived and worked in these white rooms for so long. We speak the language, but we speak the other languages too.
So we can be diplomats.
Exactly.
Because we're diplomats now anyway. We're diplomats 24/7.
That's very true.
I mean, we're diplomats 24/7, code-switching and and just who get paid to do it.
Yeah.
And you get to do it while doing some good. Like, I always remind my kids who are mixed and who grew up very nicely in Geneva that, hey, guys, there's, like, two continents where everyone looks just like you.
Yeah.
Like, if I picked them up and I dropped them in the middle of South America, no one would believe that they're Swedish.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, okay, everybody here looks
classic.
Like you're local.
Yeah.
You're local. I throw you in Namibia, you're local.
Yeah.
So, as part of being privileged...
Yeah.
And also being somebody who's basically ethnically local to the people who are in the toughest places in the world, I feel like it's part of your duty, actually, to want to give back.
100%.
I think that's really nice. I wanna nib on something, a word that you used, because we have talked a lot in this podcast about minority stress, for example, and what it's like experiencing microaggressions. And, you know, we've talked about the different levels of assimilation that we've gone through and how especially I think for me and Amber, the last 2 years, how we've really started peeling off these layers of, you know, being as white as you can be. But you used a word just now, code switching. Do you want to explain what that is for our Swedish and all our listeners? What is code switching?
Well, code switching on a basic level is the language you speak to your parents has to be different than the language you speak to your friends.
Yeah.
Even though today's generation kind of assumes we're friends. We're not friends. And today's parents have a tendency to treat their kids like you're my best friend. No, he's not your best friend. He's your son. I think it's a tendency with parents of our generation to helicopter to the point where it's like you want to blend a relationship. Where it's like, well, no, there's a hierarchy here. And that has to be respected.
Mm. Yeah, I've noticed that our lines are somewhat blurry. Who's calling the shots? Yeah, because of specifically only regarding my son, because I had him at a very young age. So we became friends, firstly. And I think that relationship structure kind of got stuck. So when I'm trying to put my foot down and being assertive, for him, it sounds like I'm suggesting things, but I'm really not.
Maybe do this.
Well, it's a code switching. Yeah. The way you talk to your friends, not the way you talk to your parents. Mm. The way you talk to your colleagues, not the way you talk to your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way you talk to your boss, not the way you talk to your, you know, colleagues on your level. Code switching is a big part of life. And then you add the ethnic mix, you add the language mix. I know the way I speak with my French friends is different than when I speak English.
Yeah.
My English and my French are two different modes and two different vibes. For example, my kids, they speak English, French, and Swedish. And, you know, they love their mother, so they speak great Swedish, enthusiastic Swedish, proud Swedish. And they hear us speak English, because I don't speak Swedish yet. But with us, our language is French.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they speak great English, their language is French. I picked up very early on that as they get older, their language of intimacy, their language of their emotional language is French. So if I really want to know how they're doing, it can't be how you're doing. It has to be comment vas-tu. Then I get the honest answer. I get the real answer and I get all the whining. But to get to their core self, it has to be French.
Oh my god, it's making me emotional when you say it, because no, because when you're saying it, I'm realizing I think my emotional language is Finnish. Like when you're saying it, like I know that if my mum would switch to, or like she always says good morning in Finnish, always, it's always huomenta.
Yeah.
Or like if it's like I love you, or just like that's it. It goes to the next. It's like in Ratatouille when he eats the food and he's like,
yes,
and he's zoomed back. Yeah. That's what happens in a.
Yes.
It's just emotions.
Yes.
Which is crazy because like I don't speak much Finnish anymore. I speak it to my relatives, but it's not a. It's not good.
But it's back there in the memory bank.
But I'm. But now when you said it,
it's deep in that child's memory banks. So. Code switching can have a negative connotation because people are like, oh wait, so you have to talk a certain way with black people or talk a certain way with white people. Mm. But it's way deeper than that.
Mm.
It's the way you talk to family and friends who are like family, and the way you talk to everybody else.
Yeah.
Everybody else who's out of the family, they get different language, different codes, and different levels of formality.
Yeah.
And formality is good. Hierarchy is good.
You're living in Stockholm in Sweden. You've been here for
3 months.
3 months.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
It's been great. My colleagues are great. They're the people I talk to the most. They're my only friends.
And apart from us.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
We're on the list with Snoop and Wu-Tang.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm just gonna.
No, I got lucky in terms of my colleagues. I found a great apartment. I'm making new friends a little bit every day. Even the woman at the migration, Verket, like I'm still working through the paperwork, need to get a bank account and personal number and residency card. All those things are works in progress.
Yeah.
The core of this move was to be closer to my children and mission accomplished.
Yeah.
Even though now I get to see them in all the time, get to see them in different sides of them because I'm part of their daily life
now. Yeah, yeah.
So now every time we get together, it's not special.
Yeah.
Now it's like, okay, you're here, man. I'll see you next week.
Yeah.
But that's what you want. I mean, in what you're describing in the end, I lived abroad for 10 years. And that is no money in the world can buy that feeling. Being close to the people in that are the most important ones in your entire world. And family is so important. But true. I also think, I mean, to me, it's just your entire story is so inspiring. And, you know, I mean, we haven't even talked about your book and like all these other, literally, you'll have to come back for another episode. But
Sweden's been good. Sweden's been good. I mean, Swedes often give themselves a hard time, but they're friendlier than people think. They're nicer than people think. They're helpful. They're warm. It helps that the weather got nice. April was tough.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll ever stop complaining about the weather.
But you notice that's what we do. Like we always talk about the weather.
It's like the British.
Yeah, it's
an icebreaker.
But it's really bad.
I mean, you know, right now it's 20 degrees and people are losing their minds. It's been 20 degrees since April 1st, like in south of here, in Paris and New York, that time zone.
But it's gotten
more diverse than it was. I've been coming here for 20 years, but I probably didn't come much the last 5, and way more. There are way more Ethiopian restaurants.
Yeah.
On my street, there's a Peruvian, Lebanese, Ethiopian, and an Indian restaurant.
I would choose the Ethiopian and injera all day, every day.
All day, all night.
Yes.
And the honey wine.
Yeah, I don't drink, but their coffee, dead.
There's going to be a Senegalese pop-up. Coming, I think it opened last week actually. Three sisters that were on a TV show, a cooking show where families competed. Oh. Yeah, so they're opening a pop up as well. I'll send that. So shout out to the Mbai sisters.
And also, work wise, here is a joy because, you know, I'm working on sustainability and we're working for these clients. And it's nice that in Sweden, most companies are predisposed to do the right thing.
Yes.
For the environment and even in diversity, like you don't have to like say, okay, we need to save the planet. And you don't have to show how badly we need to save the planet.
Yeah.
People know they get it. Now it's about implementation.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an oasis if you're into this kind of work because elsewhere, people are still like, come on, how warm are things? How warm is the planet? Is global warming really happening? You just have to fight that. And for years, I had to fight those people, that 1%, that one guy in the room who happens to be the president. And then it was like, you know, human rights, come on. But here, it's really important. Gender equality is really important.
Yeah.
So it's good to have an audience where you could actually, where clients could collaborate with to like, okay, gender equality, 60-40. It's not that much to ask because 50% of the country is women. So 60-40 it should be 50-50. 60-40.
Compromise.
Yeah. So those compromises are better to do in this context than elsewhere where it's like 90-10. Yeah. And why should we go to 88-12? I was like, come on, man. Wow. I remember your friend and our mutual friend, Nora, you know, she hit me to the fact that like 28-29% of Sweden is minorities, the Swedish population. It's like 3 million people. That's a lot of people, like 30% of the country.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
So for your company to be 30% staffed by minorities is not a hard ask. Like 30%.
No, not at all.
That means the talent pool's here.
Yeah.
Many generations and different levels of expertise is all there. I didn't know that. Coming into here, I was thinking, okay, it's probably 1 or 2%. The former colonial countries tend to be about 10% black. So I'm thinking, okay, Sweden is going to be, it's not former colonial, so at best 5%. Mm. But turns out, because of aid and refugees and over the last 30 years, it's 30%.
Yeah.
That's a huge talent pool.
Yeah.
There's no reason why your company can't reflect that.
It's not just immigrants or refugees. You have so many generations now who aren't necessarily, you know, I'm not with a ethnically Swedish person. And you see more and more of those constellations of couples who then have kids. Yes. Like my nieces, they are a quarter Finnish, Romanian, Russian and Ugandan.
So cool.
But they look like me.
So cool.
So we're seeing, you know, that is the future.
Yeah.
It's not about I am Swedish, I am this. It's we're going to be children of the world. Do you know what I mean? Like that's
And accents don't have to be perfect anymore.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, everybody doesn't have to go to SSC. Like, you know what I mean? There's going to be flexibility. Mm. There's going to need to be flexibility culturally in those ways.
Yeah.
Swedish accents don't have to be perfect. Everybody doesn't have to go to Handelskolan. Like, there's other ways.
And you're seeing it in popular culture and subcultures, because especially I find it so interesting, my boyfriend is a gamer, he loves gaming, and in that community they all speak English. From all over the world, children, men, you know, from all over the world wanting to play a game. Many are like war games or strategic games where you need to be a team and they need to have a common language to solve problems and win battles. And they're doing it online every day. Yeah. So why can't we do it when we work or when we are creating strategies or solving problems? Why is there still such a, I don't know, such a resistance to this change? I don't get it.
I don't think there's resistance. I think there's still just lack of awareness of the benefit to it. Yeah. People probably watch too much American news and think that it needs to be friction for it to happen or it needs to be combative, when actually it's just no, it's just you need more talent so you could sell more products.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need talent that comes from everywhere to give you different perspectives.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a lack of awareness on the market opportunity.
Yeah.
And how they could be deployed. HR is not as valued here as it is, I know, in America. It's a huge role for HR. But okay, the business strategy calls for, okay, we're going to grow in the Middle East more. Well, we might want to have more Arabic speakers here. Instead of hiring, you know, somebody who like studied Arabic in the school, get some native Arabic speakers. Because it's a whole different thing when it's your native speaker. Yeah. And God knows there's a lot of Swedes who are like perfectly fluent in Swedish and Arabic. And if the business strategy calls for growing the Middle East business, then you might want to do this. So I think it's more that the people are not aware on the practical applications.
Because
what they're missing from the American lesson, which is they see the mess, the noise, and the arguments, and the terrible, terrible news bites. But they miss practical deployment of collaboration between a majority and a minority to build wealth.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having this conversation with you, Dimitri, and just hearing your origin story, like literally, you know, the journey and the super cool moments with the hip hop legends, you being a legend yourself, yeah. Your time in the UN and going back to, you know, the motherland, and now your life here in Sweden. Yeah. It's been absolutely a pleasure, and having our first episode
in English
with you. Yeah.
Thanks for making the leap.
Of course,
anytime.
And who knows, man, we do this again in 5 years. I might do it in Swedish.
Yeah, who knows? Yes. No. You'll get there. And even if not, English is the...
It's fine.
Or maybe it's up to us. We could do it in French. We can top up our French.
And top up your French.
I will need more than 5 years.
Well, yeah. You know, I listen to your podcast in Swedish. So I need to listen to Swedish to see how far I have to go.
Yeah.
And I told my teacher about the podcast. I'm like, hey, this is this podcast I'm listening to right now. And I don't understand a word, but we could use it for practice. And then she listened to your podcast. So she listened to a couple. And then she came back to me. She's like, they're too advanced for you. Your Swedish is way too sophisticated. You're too far away from this. But nice try, though. Nice try. But you guys are brilliant, and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
And thank you, amazing audience, for listening.
Yes.
We love you, and we'll see you
soon
next week.
Yes. Bye.
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 Hej, jag vill bara skicka ett stort tack till er. Ni är fantastiska och ni gör ett så fint jobb med att ta upp sådana viktiga ämnen som man kanske inte alltid kan prata om i alla rum och väcker viktiga tankar. Så tusen tack till er, ni är bäst.
Hörrni gänget, glöm inte att subscriba på podden där du lyssnar på poddar, och framförallt betygsätt, give us them 5 stars.
5 stars.
Let everyone know att Checkpoint is here to stay.
Och glöm inte att gå in och supporta oss på Acast Support.
Följ oss på Instagram, checkpoint_podcast.
Do it now.
Checkpoint!
Med mig, Brandon, och...
Your girl, Anbara.
Och Nicole.
Yay!
Tjus, hej då!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.